Thank you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, this evening we have with us David Geyer. He and his father have been studying the situation as far as thimerosal in our vaccines, in our childhood vaccines, their impact upon the lives, the future, not only of the children, but of this very country. Because you have to understand that today, according to the CDC, one in every six children in the United States has either a neurodevelopmental abnormality or behavior abnormality. Certainly one in six children has asthma. The health of our children is progressively deteriorating. And the question is, why? Well, all we can say is that there's been a skyrocketing incidence of autism, coinciding with the increased number of childhood vaccines that were given to our children containing thimerosal. And this really, when it started out, nobody could figure out why the incidence of autism, which was a relatively very rare condition, one in 10,000 children, was beginning to increase and increase so rapidly. And fortunately, here in the state of California, they kept a very careful record of that because of state laws. And they saw the increase of autism just going through the roof. The boys, the lives of mostly young boys, totally devastated by this terrible disease. And well, I'm going to let David Geyer tell us what he and his father have found out. David, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, can you just speak up a little louder, please?
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Now, tell us what you found as you began to looking into the background of the relationship between thimerosal and autism and other neurodevelopmental abnormalities, because certainly the CDC, the vaccine manufacturers, people within government say there's absolutely nothing to worry about. Even the Institute of Medicine came out with a report and said, don't do any more studies on this. What's this all about?
Well, what we're talking about here with thimerosal is a mercury-containing compound that was found in childhood vaccines.
Well, it was actually put in childhood vaccines,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
It was intentionally put in as a preservative. It contains 50% mercury by weight. And to know a little bit about the history of my father and I, looking at vaccine safety, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, my father and I were studying a database called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS database. And this is a government database specifically designed to monitor adverse reactions to vaccines. And we were publishing a number of studies, actually in many ways working with CDC. They were providing us with data, with the ability to access this database. And we were publishing studies in the scientific and medical journals. And in many cases, our results seem to be in agreement with the government's publications. And around 2001, early 2002, a group of parents started coming up to us and telling us a very different story about what vaccines might be potentially doing to children. They said that over the course of the last decade or so, the number of shots containing the mercury from thimerosal had rapidly increased. And they said the rate of autism had gone up dramatically in the United States, and that there must be a direct link between the mercury in the shots and autism. And our first reaction was, you know, the amount of television watching has gone up in the last 10 years. Just because you observe two phenomena doesn't necessarily mean that they're linked. But we started examining this VAERS database, and we started to find that there was indeed a direct link between the mercury and the shots.
Hold that thought right there, David, and we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. This is an amazing and very, very important subject that you're not going to hear covered well in the general media. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and with us this evening is David Geyer. David, why don't you tell our listeners before we go on just a little bit about yourself and about your father? Are you still studying? Are you doing any university work at the present time? What is your background?
I'm currently still at George Washington University in the biochemistry department, going after my PhD, in the past I've worked at the National Institutes of Health for a year or so. So I come from there. My father worked actually for 10 years at the NIH, the professor at Johns Hopkins University. He's been in private medical practice in the Washington, D.C. area for the last 25 or so years. And together we've been studying vaccine safety, like I said, the last probably, now it's been 5 or 6 years, analyzing government databases.
All right, fine. And so the parents came to you and pointed out that they thought that there was a causal relationship between the marked increase of thimerosal-containing vaccines given to children and the skyrocketing incidence of autism. And initially you sort of poo-pooed the idea. And then, of course, as you began to analyze the data, what did you find?
What we saw was that the parents, it turns out that their stories were right. Even though you might think listening to this, just like when we first heard it, it's high in the sky. You know, most children in the country are vaccinated. So if a child develops autism, you might think it might be linked to the vaccine. But when we really started to look at the data, what we found was the parent's story was right. The more mercury the children got from these thimerosal-containing vaccines, the more risk they had of autism, speech disorders, attention deficit disorders, this whole spectrum of neurodevelopmental disorders that are really epidemic proportions in the United States. And we began to look at the literature on thimerosal, and what you find is that there are literally hundreds of articles talking about the toxicity of thimerosal dating all the way back to the 1930s. And these articles say we injected it, we applied it topically to people, they developed neurological problems, we got to get rid of this from medicine. But unfortunately, people just sort of in the regulatory agencies brushed over, or in some cases were even influenced to look the other way, with the result that as the years went by, children kept getting more and more mercury from their shots, until finally we got to a point in 91, 92, where some children were getting 129 times what the EPA recommends a child should be exposed to for mercury.
Hold that thought there for just a moment as we prepare to bring our other stations back on board right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is David Geyer, and he's telling about what happened as he and his father began to look at the database, and what they found, and this was the government VAERS database, they found that the more mercury the child got, the greater their chance was of developing a neurodevelopmental abnormality, either autism or speech disorders or learning disorders or all the myriad of disorders that children can get, ADD, ADHD, Asperger's disease. And so they found out that as more and more vaccines were given containing toxic doses of mercury, one of the most toxic substances known to mankind, some of these children were getting 125 times the maximum allowable amount of mercury. Was that correct?
Yeah, in one day, as an example, at 2 months of age, children could be exposed to 62.5 micrograms of mercury from several different shots containing this thimerosal. And when you calculate their allowable dose according to the EPA guidelines, and this is something I guess everybody that's listening should know, the EPA has set a limit for exposure to mercury of 0.1 microgram of mercury per kilogram body weight per day. So an average infant at 2 months of age weighs about 5 kilograms, it's about 12 pounds. So using that 0.1 limit, they were allowed 0.5. They got to 62.5. That's 129-fold over the EPA safety limit. And this was a pattern. Each time during the routine childhood vaccine schedule, these children over and over again received these massive bolus doses of mercury. At 4 months, they came back again. At 6 months, again. At 15 months, again.
And of course, sometimes, so often I've heard this story, and I'm sure you have as well, that, you know, the parent will say, my child was fine. They were meeting all the regular the patterns of advancement. They began to stand and walk and began to talk at the right time. And then within a few days after this, all these vaccines that were given, suddenly they began to regress. Had you heard that story?
Yeah, that's so often the case. This is what the kind of autism that I'm talking about is really very different than what first pops into people's heads. We're not talking about somebody like the Rain Man. These children were born normal, as you said, meeting all their developmental milestones, and then they underwent regression in the second and third year of life. And this kind of symptoms follows exactly what you see in mercury poisoning. First time a person is exposed to mercury, that first day you invariably see no symptoms. It's the cumulative exposure over multiple times of receiving mercury that eventually builds up to a level where a child or even as an adult you reach your toxic tipping point, and that's when you really start to see the symptoms. And in many times when that happens, what you see is a regression whereby you lose language, you lose your mental abilities, you start to have psychiatric problems. It's just a whole host of things that mercury can do in the body.
And then, of course, when you go back to the doctor and you tell him this happened right after the shot, the doctor is very defensive, and understandably so, because he's afraid he's going to get sued for this. He assures the parent that there's absolutely no relationship between the vaccines and the regression of the child. And, of course, the CDC and government agencies keep insisting that this is the case. There's absolutely no proof at all there's any relationship between the toxic amounts of thimerosal, sometimes up to 125 times the maximum allowable dose, and of course the damage that's done to the children's minds. Now, if this is really a problem though, David, why don't all the children who take these shots get the signs of mercury toxicity?
Well, this is an area that my father and I and other researchers have really started to look into. It's a good question, and we've started to address it. What it turns out is that certain children, and these are the ones that are affected, have more susceptibility than other children. And we've all heard that there's genetic susceptibilities to various exposures. A good example being lung cancer. Clearly, everybody that smokes doesn't develop lung cancer. It's only certain people. And people flippantly or say constantly in the press, you read about, well, they must have a genetic susceptibility. And the interesting thing in autism is that kind of susceptibility, both genetically and biochemically, has now been identified and is well published in the peer-reviewed literature in autism. And what you see in autistics is that they have low amounts of a substance called glutathione. Glutathione is a compound that contains sulfhydro groups. Those are sulfur-containing atoms, and they, with very high affinity, bind mercury in the body. And when you look at autistic children versus children, neurotypical children, what you see is autistics have about a 50% reduction in the amount of glutathione in their body. And hence, they have a vastly reduced ability to excrete the mercury they're exposed to from the childhood vaccines. And so it's much more likely to build up the toxic levels in their brain. And people have taken it a step further and looked at the genetic basis for this difference in glutathione, and people have identified certain genetic differences in these autistics which help account for their susceptibility. What they have are, they're called SNPs, but they're really just subtle genetic differences that result in their ability to produce slightly less glutathione. And what we're talking about here is not really a genetic defect, because absence the huge mercury exposure from the vaccines, these children would have been normal. It's only when you start adding more and more shots containing mercury in the first couple of years of life that you're going to start picking off people that are susceptible to mercury toxicity.
All right, so there seems to be a very definite causal relationship, and this is what you found when you went through the VAERS database information. But then you found that there was other information out there, that there were much more extensive databases kept by some of the HMOs, where they would have some children that would get the the vaccines with the thimerosal, and other children would get vaccines that did not have the thimerosal. Usually the DPT vaccine, some of the vaccine was made with thimerosal, other was made without thimerosal. And what did you find? First of all, what happened when you tried to access this CDC database? And then, of course, what did you find when you finally got into it, over tremendous objection, everything being done to keep you and your father from getting access to the information?
I think what you're referring to is we initially went into VAERS, which is a CDC-sponsored database, but that's available to the public. CDC, when we started reporting that there was a link out of this publicly available database, said, well, you can't see our secret database called the Vaccine Safety Data Link. That's a database that CDC established, and it contains records from several different managed care organizations in California and the Pacific Northwest, and that was only something CDC could see. And they claimed, when they looked at that database, that they didn't see an effect of thimerosal on these neurodevelopmental disorders. But we started petitioning, along with several congressmen who were sort of sponsoring us, to get us in to see that data. And it took us about a year and a half with congressmen on the phone with us, along with the CDC, and the congressmen finally forced our way in, and we got a good look at the government data, and we started comparing children that had thimerosal-containing DTaP versus thimerosal-free. We saw, just like what we were seeing in the public databases, that the more mercury children got, the more risk they had of these neurodevelopmental disorder conditions. And in some cases, the relative risk was over tenfold higher with children that got high-dose exposure to thimerosal versus very, very low-dose exposure. So this database emphatically confirmed exactly what we were seeing in the public database.
But of course, the government did everything they could to block you from getting into that, didn't they?
They did everything they could, and once we found the link and we started to publicly announce that there was one in their own database, first thing CDC did was they threw us out of the ability to see that VSD database. And we had to fight for over a year to try to get back in. And it took, there's a Institute of Medicine report. The Institute of Medicine is a part of the National Academy of Sciences, held hearings on whether external researchers could see this secret government data.
Now, why would they have it secret? I mean, after all, it's paid for by the public. Why can't the public see what the government knows about doing harm to our children?
Well, I can say, as somebody that has seen it, unfortunately, for many, many years, CDC has been covering over and trying to smooth over concerns with vaccine safety. And they've been using the secret VSD database as a means to do it. Researchers like us, like other ones, who have found problems with vaccines, the CDC researchers went into VSD and sort of waved a magic wand in a dark room and came out and said, you know, we looked at our database and there isn't any effect, and you can't see it, only we can see it, and you got to take the vaccines anyways. It's sort of a way to try to restore public confidence without allowing external researchers to be able to confirm or refute what the government was saying.
But why should we trust the government? We saw what they did with the AIDS epidemic. You had an epidemic that was easily controllable, and 500,000 Americans have died, another million are infected. That's a failed public health policy coordinated by our Centers for Disease Control. Why would we want to trust government bureaucrats? Ronald Reagan said was, always believe, but always certainly check and make sure it's true. Or always accept, but always make sure, always confirm, too. And so you were trying to confirm that really what was in this database, and there were government officials that were doing everything they could to keep the public from knowing the truth, and we have to ask ourselves why. And of course, what's really so interesting is that now that the thimerosal has been removed from the childhood vaccines, we're beginning to see, here in California, as we're watching it, beginning to see a drop in the incidence of autistic children. So we're going to be back in just a moment or two with David Geyer, telling you this incredible, incredible story. Well, David, my understanding is that when you actually got into the database, that you know, into the CDC, they set this thing up so there was really no way you could access the information. You'd come there, you'd brought in a special consultant who knew how to use the program. And why don't you tell our listeners that story? Because I thought that was so interesting. Obviously, even though that they were forced to let you in by congressional pressure, they were going to make sure you didn't get any information.
Yeah, what happened was that when we finally, when Congress forced our way in, we were forced to pay $3,200 to the CDC for them to create a data set for us to look at, and then they charged us $1,000 a day for each day we actually went down to the government's research data center. And when we went down there the first day, we went to this building that, you can imagine this, it doesn't even have a sign identifying what it is. That's how secret it is. We went in the front door. They have armed guards at the front door, and they literally have to escort you from the front desk with the armed guards to this sort of like a small room without any windows, tucked away way in the middle of the building. And we went there, and there was one computer terminal that had our specially prepared data set on it. We sat down and we started looking at this computer to see if we could access the VSD data set prepared for us. And as it turned out, the government had intentionally left off an interface for us to be able to access it. So we were basically completely stymied, and the people at this research data center were all gloating, oh, you know, that's the way it is. You know, we have this interface on our computers, but CDC says you don't get one to be able to access it. And they closed the door, and we were left with a technical monitor. It was actually a woman. And she announced when they closed the door, she had an affected child, and she was going to help us see what we needed to see in the VSD database. And the result was, over 2 days, even though we didn't have any help from CDC, and they'd intentionally given us a way to access the VSD that was very, very difficult, she helped us write computer programs. Over the course of 2 days, we got good, solid data looking at children, like I said, looking that received thimerosal-containing DTaP versus thimerosal-free DTaP, and we found this amazing confirmation from our public databases. And the second time, it was very interesting. So the first time we went there 2 days, we arranged for two more days, and at the second time, CDC hired a new technical monitor to review our activities, and they actually had two of them there. So they had a monitor for the monitor to monitor our research. And at the second time, we made some printouts trying to get further results to further expand and confirm what we'd done the first time. And these technical monitors, under direct instructions from the CDC, gave us our printouts completely whited out. And the result was we got no information out. And then, as I said, after that second access time, we began to release the results of our first time looking at the VSD to the public. And as soon as we did that, the CDC terminated our ability to see the VSD database.
And so they obviously have something to hide. And what they don't want the parents to know is that they've been poisoning our children. And the thing is that they know what's going on. They just don't want the public to know. We're going to be back here in just a moment with David Geyer, going into more of this incredible story of how they've been giving mercury to our children. Well, David, telling us that they were very, very fortunate when they went into the CDC the first time. The situation had been set up so there was just no way they could get any information. They'd already put out $4,000 or $5,000, well over $4,000 to get there, and they were given a computer, but of course there was no way to access it. Fortunately, there was a woman at the CDC who had a child who was autistic, who came and helped them and allowed them to really get the information that showed that there was about a tenfold increase in the instance of autism in the children that were getting mercury. And the more mercury it got, the higher the instance of autism. They went back a second time, and this time they would not let them get any access at all. They printed out material, they were taken by the monitors and completely erased. So here you see a massive government cover-up. And why would they be covering up if there was nothing to cover up? Well, anyway, when David and his father, Dr. Mark Geyer, published this information, suddenly they could not get into the database again. Has anybody else been able to get into the database to confirm your findings?
Nobody's been able to get in. What, as I mentioned, they kicked us out, and there was this Institute of Medicine hearing, which came down very strongly on our side, encouraging open access, and even went so far as to say that the CDC, in order for them to work with this VSD database in the future, they needed to have one panel of independent people made up of parents, lawyers, you know, concerned people from the community to oversee the way in which CDC was doing internal research on the VSD, and a second oversight panel to oversee that external researchers could see this VSD database.
Now, that was what, the 2004 Institute of Medicine report?
It's actually 2005.
2005. Well, I understand, though, that they got another meeting together where they said, you know, which basically the CDC had gotten together to negate that, to say when there's no evidence of any connection and we don't want any more research at all. And weren't there even directives from the CDC telling the Institute of Medicine what to say? What was that all about?
What I'm talking about is a February 2005 IOM report.
Right.
The previous year, in February 2004, the CDC called on the Institute of Medicine to look at the relationship between vaccines and autism. And they held a major hearing, and numerous experts from around the world, including us, said that there was a link between the thimerosal and vaccines and autism. But despite those presentations, under basically direction from CDC and influence by CDC, this Institute of Medicine panel issued a report saying that vaccines or thimerosal doesn't cause autism, that it's not biologically plausible, the relationship, that children should have no preference for thimerosal-free vaccines, that autistic children shouldn't be treated for mercury toxicity, and that no further research should be done in this area.
Oh, that was the 2004 report. Then how did you get the 2005 report? Because certainly the last thing the CDC wants, and these officials, who in my opinion are really guilty of criminal activity, how did you get the 2005 Institute of Medicine report going?
Well, what happened there, I believe, is that the CDC was not happy just having the 2004, which cut off almost everything associated with investigating the thimerosal-autism link. They were trying to take it a step further and get another Institute of Medicine to declare that the VSD database was off-limits and that there shouldn't be any kind of oversight of the way CDC was doing its own research in the VSD database. But unfortunately for the CDC, when they called this new Institute of Medicine, it was a new panel of people, really scientific and medical experts, who were hearing the data or hearing the presentations, and the head of it was a guy named Dr. Baylar, who had a long history actually of trying to open up government data. So they got stuck with the head of an IOM committee who was very much committed to the idea of having openness. And of course, when the hearing was occurred, the CDC's positions were just absolutely abomination. Their people literally got up before the IOM panel and said, "External researchers cannot see government data."
So if there's nothing to conceal, why are they concealing it? Because think of the implications, ladies and gentlemen in the audience. We're talking about billions of dollars of lawsuits that are justifiably should be brought against the insurance company, the vaccine manufacturers, who've known exactly what they were doing. They were told, or certainly Merck was told, you know, back in the early 90s by Dr. Hilleman, who was their chief vaccinologist, you know, that they were giving, I think, 87 times the maximum allowable dose, 87 times the maximum allowable amount of mercury to children on their first day of life in the nursery. They knew what they were doing. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and pick up the story from there, David.
So this new 2005 Institute of Medicine heard this evidence from CDC about external researchers shouldn't be allowed to see the data. And yes, the government had destroyed data in the VSD database, but that was acceptable because it was standard scientific procedure to destroy data. And they presented a whole detailed description about the CDC's own investigation into thimerosal and how they went through what they called an iterative process, whereby they were, through a whole series of changes, they were able to initially find a link between thimerosal and neurodevelopmental disorders, and eventually to make the effect disappear and try to justify that that was okay. We presented to the Institute of Medicine panel that it was not okay what they were doing and that we were basically totally being mistreated by them, and came out in February of 2005 a report that very seriously admonished the CDC for both the way they were conducting studies and the way that they were treating us. And it's interesting that that report came out on a Thursday. Friday at 5 o'clock in the evening, CDC issued a press release saying that certain people had been fired at the National Immunization Program who were dealing with vaccine safety. So it's kind of interesting. This report came out, and even though most people in the general population haven't heard about thimerosal, haven't heard about any of this controversy, and your first reaction is to just blow this over, people at the CDC have already been fired over the way they've dealt with this whole issue.
But, of course, nothing's really changed, has it? I mean, they may have fired them, but they still are working with some other department. And has anything really changed as far as their cover-up of the relationship between thimerosal and the destruction of the minds of so many children?
Well, I think that they were fired, and what's gone on is sort of a situation of the status quo with CDC.
Were they really fired, or were they just transferred elsewhere?
People were really fired.
They were really fired.
The chief of the National Immunization Program's Vaccine Safety Division no longer works on vaccines at all, and the entire Vaccine Safety Division was literally ripped right out of the National Immunization Program and put under Julie Gerberding's control. So there was massive reshuffling, massive removal of people that went on.
But I mean, did anybody get fired from their government job? In other words, do they still have government jobs? Did somebody actually get fired? And hold that, we'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is David Geyer, and he's pointing out that the Institute of Medicine report came out in February this year. Now, you wouldn't have read that in your media because this sort of thing is censored from the American people, but of course they were very critical of the CDC, and that very day or the following day, why, of course, the people in the vaccine division at the CDC were fired. And I was just asking that they were, did they lose their government jobs and government pensions, or were they simply shifted to another department? Do we know?
I think some of them were shifted to another department, but I don't know all the details.
All right. They did this. Now, how can our listeners out there get this report from the Institute of Medicine? How would it be we be able to find that on the Internet? Is it posted someplace?
It's posted on the IOM's website. If you go to www.iom.edu, the title of this report from 2005 is Vaccine Safety Data Link Access and Public Trust. And it goes into detail about what CDC needs to do about restructuring itself to look at vaccines. And it also provides a very thorough review of the CDC's own examination of the thimerosal issue. As I mentioned, CDC back in 1999 first began to look at thimerosal and its link with neurodevelopmental disorders in children. They did a number of studies in this VSD database. We actually have the results of those studies, and we even have the emails from the CDC researchers where they expressed a large amount of concern that there was truly a link between thimerosal and neurodevelopmental disorders. And these emails have subject lines like, it just won't go away, and they're thinking about rethinking, reevaluating, rerunning the data. It's all about how they're going to manipulate the programs and trying various things to make the effects go away, but it seems to continue to be there. It's very, very hard to make the effect disappear. And things got so bad, as far as the CDC data was concerned, that in June of 2000, a secret closed-door meeting was held at a place called Simpsonwood. This is a United Methodist Retreat Center in the North Georgia woods, where CDC and the vaccine manufacturers got together, and they actually discussed the results of the CDC's investigations into thimerosal. And there was an official transcript kept of this secret meeting. And the CDC people, when I say it's secret, the CDC people actually said on the transcript, "We've asked you to keep this information confidential." And after that announcement, the head CDC researcher gets up and he goes down a whole laundry list of all the links that he's found between thimerosal and autism, ADD, speech delay, language delay, all these different things. And then the people in the meeting say, "Oh my God, how are we going to make this go away?" And the term they use is they were going to work on pushing and pulling the data to make the effect disappear.
But didn't some of the people there say, "Well, we're not going to give this to our grandchildren," or words to that effect?
Yeah, there were people that were so concerned at that presentation. It was Dr. Richard Johnston said actually on the transcript that he went out and he made a call to his, I think it was his daughter who just gave birth to their grandson, or to his grandson, and he advised her not to give thimerosal-containing vaccines to that grandchild, but he wasn't going to tell the public about this problem.
No, we wouldn't want to tell the public and let them know so they could protect their grandchildren. That's what's so irritating about this whole thing. David, it's this elitist attitude of these people in these conferences and the elitist people within the upper echelons of organized medicine who really seem to have a condescending attitude towards the common people.
I think that they believe in their hearts, the ones who, there may be some at CDC who are bought off or being manipulated, but the ones who are honest, if you can call this honesty, is that they feel that the thimerosal issue is so big, if it was to come out, it would cause so much damage in the public's confidence in the whole vaccine program, that the best course of action here is to, you know, stay up at night and worry about what you did, but in public come out and say that there is no link.
In other words, a lie.
Yeah, it's a lie. It's sort of they're lying for your own good.
Well, now, they say that they've taken the thimerosal out of childhood vaccines. Do we know that they've really done that? We know that they were told to in 1999. We know that it was still in there in the year 2003. And we know that it's still being given to children throughout the rest of the world. It's just we've taken it out here in the United States. How can they justify giving this toxic substance to children throughout the rest of the world, but not here in America?
Well, the thimerosal still is in childhood vaccines. Let me make that very clear.
All right.
And I'm not talking, my father and I both are willing to accept what's called trace, meaning less than 1 microgram. But unfortunately, there are still vaccines routinely being given to children that contain 25 micrograms of mercury per shot.
Now, which ones are those, do we know?
The biggest one of concern is the influenza vaccine.
All right, fine.
What has occurred there is, as you said, in 1999, the recommendation came out to begin to remove thimerosal from childhood vaccines. And there was a very long, lengthy, horribly slow process to begin to get it out of the vaccine. And the result was by 2003, most of the routine childhood vaccines were thimerosal-free or contained trace amounts. But just as soon as that happened, the following fall, in 2004, the CDC made the recommendation to start giving thimerosal-containing influenza vaccines to all infants and children. And their recommendation is to give 3 shots of thimerosal-containing influenza vaccines in the first 18 months of life. So in effect, the CDC, despite this announcement that they were working to get thimerosal out, has reneged on that, and at least part based on that 2004 institution Institute of Medicine report that I mentioned that says we're going to state no preference, and the result is now children are beginning to be exposed to increasing doses of mercury again from childhood vaccine.
All right. Now, what about the diphtheria tetanus, not the DPT, but the diphtheria tetanus? Have they taken that out of that? And what about these vaccines that are given to some of the older children, the meningococcal vaccine they want to give to everybody entering a college and things like that, the pneumococcal vaccines? Do they have thimerosal in them, or do we know?
There are other ones, as you're saying, but these are given to more select populations. Things like DT vaccine, tetanus vaccine, tetanus diphtheria, meningitis.
They all have the mercury, the full dose of mercury in it?
Yeah, at least in some of the formulations. What's really required, unfortunately, is, as a parent, you need to look at the vaccine package inserts. You need to look at the vials, the box, and confirm with your own eyes to make sure that the product being administered to your child or even to you is thimerosal or mercury-free.
And even, of course, adults can get toxic reactions if they have a genetic predisposition. Can't adults get reactions to the mercury?
There are adults that seem to react. And just to quickly go through the math again, if you're an adult, let's say a 70-kilogram adult, that means you weigh 132 pounds, this EPA safety limit I mentioned allows you to have 7 micrograms. An influenza shot by itself in one day has 25 micrograms, so you're over threefold over the EPA limit. This is probably a very bad thing, and certainly we see some adults who manifest with things like MS or Guillain-Barré syndrome after receiving these kinds of vaccines.
Well, now, what about the... certainly we know that the nurses, that there was a large series of nurses who had taken the hepatitis B vaccine, and they had 3 times the incidence of MS that you would find in the general population. So, or nurses that had not taken the hepatitis B vaccine. Do you think there was mercury in that was responsible? Do we have any idea of knowing?
In looking, I think it's plausible that the mercury could cause that. We don't, at this point, have definitive data saying that it's the mercury component of the hepatitis B vaccine that's causing that. But it's certainly a plausible explanation based on what mercury can do and the fact of where mercury can go in the body. And I think this is something that's really important that people need to consider. Even if you were an adult or a child and you got these vaccines and you didn't manifest with autism or some other neurological disorder, what the latest studies out of the NIH show is that a certain percentage, and actually it's a fairly significant percentage, of the mercury from thimerosal goes into the brain and it gets converted into something called inorganic mercury. And this this inorganic mercury has this unfortunate property that it doesn't get eliminated from the brain. The studies show that that kind of mercury has no demonstrable half-life being the time required to remove half the mercury from the brain. These things just permanently stay lodged in the brain for some people say maybe as long as 30 years.
Well, then, isn't this an accumulative thing that you'd get the mercury in your childhood vaccines and you'd get it through the course of your life, and then you might get it from your fillings? Some people think that the fillings are a constant source of this. Certainly fish and air and water. So isn't this a mercury accumulation cumulative?
Yeah, what for the first time these new studies are really showing in a very succinct way is that even for the children that we're calling neurotypical in this thimerosal, huge dosage of thimerosal generation, which really lasts 15 or 20 years or so, those children have very high levels of mercury in their brain. And so even though they didn't manifest in childhood with autism, they have an awful lot of mercury to go into life with. And so they may, earlier in life with exposure from mercury in fish, mercury from amalgams, possibly other sources, manifest with neurological disorders that would have normally occurred absent the childhood vaccine exposure at, let's say, age 70, but now that they got all the mercury in childhood, it'll bring it forward in time to maybe age 50. So we really, as a society, need to be a lot more concerned about mercury toxicity and how much mercury we're being exposed to.
And I really think certainly, I mean, it's amazing to me that we see all this concern about the mercury in the fish, but no concern about, of course, in the vaccines, where we inject it directly into the bodies. My understanding was that they outlawed the use of thimerosal, which was really methylate and mercurochrome, you know, back sometime in the 1980s, because it was too toxic to put on the skin, but somehow it was all right to inject into the bodies.
Yeah, that's very true. In 1982, an FDA advisory panel concluded that methylate was too toxic for use on skin, but for all the way through today, we continue to inject it into to infants in the vaccines. The logic behind that is really seriously suspect.
You have to sort of wonder what could they be thinking about. Now, my understanding is that at least in the last year or so, since the thimerosal has come out of most childhood vaccines, well, we're beginning to see a fall in the incidence of autism. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, that's very, very true. We have actually a paper under consideration on that topic where we looked at this VAERS database I mentioned before. And what we saw was that all throughout the 90s, just like in data all around this country, there was a rapid increase in the number of cases or reports of autism falling vaccines in this database. But then starting at the end of 1999 into 2000, 2001, we started to see a decline in the number of new cases of autism entering into that database. And this is something that has been, as you mentioned, seen in California, where the number of new cases of autism for the last year and a half, 2 years, has actually been on the decrease. This trend line that all throughout the 90s had gone up, 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 since the last couple of years has actually switched directions and is now going down.
Well, that really is encouraging. And the other thing is, I understand that you and your dad had been doing some studies, you know, with testosterone blockers in some of these boys, and at least you had one case that was dramatic. Have you had the chance to try this technique and any others? Could you explain to our listeners what the technique is, the rationale for it, and what's happened in the limited experience you've had?
This is a very interesting area. It goes into, you mentioned when you were describing earlier on the show about this huge epidemic of autism. Autism affects far more males than females. It's something like 5 or 6 to 1. And so we got very interested in studying what the basis was, or how could it be that mercury could cause so many more males than females to be damaged. And what one finds is that if you do tissue culture where you grow neurons and you expose them to thimerosal or mercury, you can kill them. But if you add in testosterone, you actually make the toxicity of mercury much, much worse. Whereas if you add in estrogen into that same system, it tends to ameliorate mercury toxicity. So being a male is sort of a risk factor for mercury toxicity. Males are much more sensitive than females. And so we got interested in looking at how much testosterone really was in autistic children. And what we found was that they tended to have a lot more testosterone than you might expect. And hence, a lot of them developed precocious puberty, meaning that they went into puberty very young because they had so much testosterone around. And so we've developed a whole protocol whereby we try to lower their testosterone level using FDA-approved drugs called Luprin, or one of which is called Luprin, and you can actually lower their testosterone. And we've done that. At the same time, we've done various techniques to try to remove the mercury from their body. And as you said, we had initially one child that responded very, very well to this kind of therapy, and now we're up to about 7 or 8 children that have responded, and we're working on enrolling additional children.
Now, has this been a dramatic increase, improvement, or has it been a subtle improvement? What has really happened to the children?
It's been a very dramatic improvement that we've seen. Really, what we've done or seen with this kind of therapy is that the real heart of the symptoms of autism really begin to fall away. Autism is a disorder of social isolation. It's of very little affection, very little communication kind of skills. These children, the classic example is that they're like off in their own little world and they sit in a corner. And what we see doing this kind of therapy is that these children that don't talk to their parents, who don't participate with anybody, they start to come out of that shell and they really start to become an acceptable member of their family.
And that's really a dramatic thing. Do you have a website or any way people can get in touch with you or your father if they'd like to? You have a website?
We don't have a website.
All right, fine. Well, our guest this evening has been David Geyer. He and his father have been doing some remarkable work, not only in the analysis of the cause of this terrible disability, but in the treatment. And we're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. David, hang on just for a moment during the break here. Well, our guest is David Geyer, and we've been talking about the epidemic of autism that has destroyed the lives of countless tens of thousands of our young people, and to the point where one in six children in America, according to the CDC, has either a neurodevelopmental or a behavioral abnormality. What are your thoughts, David? Where do we go from here?
Well, I think what we need is some openness and accountability on the part of the government. That's really what the first necessary step is. Government needs to acknowledge that, yes, at least some children have been affected by the mercury in their shots, and that based on that, they're going to turn really the full resources of the NIH and the other great research institutions in this country towards treating these children.
But I talked to Boyd Haley, Professor Haley. I know you're well acquainted with him, professor at the University of Chemistry at the University of Kentucky. He said the NIH has cut off all grants to anybody who is investigating the relationship between mercury toxicity and Alzheimer's disease. So obviously there's some people there who don't seem to be interested in getting to the truth.
I think the problem is the first step is you need it. Actually, even before that, first step is to remove all the mercury.
Right.
Second step is to acknowledge that something has happened, that people have been overexposed. This is an area worthy of investigation. Right now, unfortunately, nobody in NIH and the government is willing to look into this because they say these are disorders of unknown causes, and of course, if you don't have a cause, you can't have place to research.
But if you don't look, you're not going to find the cause either.
Well, they need to admit what's happened, and we need to investigate and try to clean up the pieces of what's left.
And of course, to save the fragmented lives of so many children. But not only that, but the incidence of Alzheimer's disease is skyrocketing, and that's according to Dr. Haley and many people I've checked with, there seems to be a definite causal relationship between mercury and, of course, this terrible, terrible disease of Alzheimer's disease, which is increasing rapidly in our society today. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure having you and having your father with us. And we just get so much better program when we just have one of you on the line for some reason or other, why we seem to have all sorts of problems. But this has been a great program. Thank you so very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us here at Radio Liberty.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, and God bless you. Give my best to your father.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. And the information is out there, ladies and gentlemen. The truth is out there, but it's up to you to get the truth and go to the Institute of Medicine report, or we'll tell you a little bit more how to get the information here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and if what we've said seems incredible, well, this couldn't be going on in America, why, certainly Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or somebody like that would tell us if this was really going on, or our congressman would know about it, or, well, some of the congressmen do know about it, and they've been doing everything they can, certainly. Daniel Burton, and Dr. Weldon, David Weldon is a physician, congressman, and a handful of others are trying to do something, but meeting tremendous resistance. Now, there is a book called The Evidence of Harm. written by David Kirby, the story of how they're poisoning our children with mercury. And we have four tape sets and videos and other material on this subject, which we think is so important. And you need to begin looking and searching out the information. It's up on the Internet. You can go to nomercury.com, or you can go to Without Informed Consent website, or go to my website at radioliberty.com, radioliberty.com, and look at the information that we have there on mercury toxicity and the tape sets and the books and other things that are available. You need to find out if it's true. Tape sets on vaccines certainly go into this very subject, or if you'd be interested in getting copies of this tape or other programs we do, why, you can always give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If what we're saying is not true, you have nothing to worry about. If what we're saying is true, there is a government cover-up, and children are having their lives destroyed, and we've really poisoned a whole generation of our American children, think of the implications of that. Can a great nation survive if we destroyed the minds of given toxic doses of mercury, which would be cumulative to the lives of these children, and as they eat fish and, of course, drink mercury-contaminated water, and they have their fillings in their mouth, their mercury fillings, which contain a phenomenal amount of mercury in it. You know, they've outlawed the use of mercury thermometers. When I went to my medical school, up until the time I finished practicing medicine, we had mercury thermometers. They've outlawed them now. Criminal activity use them because they contain mercury. Sphygmomanometers, what we use to check blood pressure. We can't have the mercury sphygmomanometers anymore. They're too toxic. But we can put mercury into fillings. That's perfectly all right. And you really need to hear my interviews with Professor Haley from the University of Kentucky. And, of course, what you find out, as he told me when we talked just this last week or so, the NIH has cut off all of his funding and the funding of any other professor who wanted to do the research on the relationship between mercury fillings and the neurodegenerative diseases we're seeing. Skyrocketing today. Government has no idea why they're there, but of course they can assure us it's not from the fillings. Well, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Let me mention we are having our annual conference here in the Monterey Bay area on the 19th of November. That's the 19th of November all day long, and we hope that you'd like to be interested in coming. Remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. If you go to our website, you can listen to our radio programs on the Internet 5 hours a day. You can listen then to our archive programs. And please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty and for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. Our guest this evening is Philip Hoge, and Philip has done some amazing research into the background of weather control. Now, it is difficult for most people to believe that we have the capacity to control the weather. Well, I know when I get on my computer, and I want to say, look at a website, and I only have to type in the www, the first letter of the thing I'm going to be looking for, and my computer already knows the rest of it. They put it up on the screen under a little blue line there. Of course, I can delete that, but the computer is able to anticipate my actions. We know that there were a number of terrorists that were involved, and the second bombing in London about 2 weeks after the July 7th bombing, and they, of course, had fled from the country, but they were able to track them all down. How? They can track anybody in the country down through electronics. We have something called HARP. We have the means up in Alaska and through other stations throughout the world to heat the ionosphere, but it's a top-secret government activity. We know that certainly Zygmunt Brzezinski, writing back in 1972 in his book, The Between Two Ages, American Technotronic Age, Zygmunt Brzezinski in 1972 was writing about weather control and the ability to control the weather and to create great control storms. Well, you know, they've known how to control the weather for a long period of time. There are all sorts of treaties on this, but they're not going to tell the American people that they can create storms and direct them. And, well, I'm going to let you hear from Philip Hoge because he knows a lot more about it than I do. Philip, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Well, it's nice to be with you, and I know a little bit about Monterey.
All right. Well, it's one of the most beautiful areas in the world, and we're blessed to live here.
Yeah, I've done a little scuba diving out there.
Okay, fine. Over here in Santa Cruz, you had to go over there in Monterey.
I was actually over in Monterey Bay.
Right, well, that's we are on Monterey Bay, but we know that there are a lot of scuba diving areas over there, and all throughout the bay, it's a beautiful place to live. Well, tell me, how did you get interested in researching weather modification and weather control?
Well, a number of years back, about 15 or 20 years back, I started getting interested in general in the concept of preparedness. And I guess it's if you take at some point in your life, you start stepping back and kind of slowing down and getting out of the rat race, and you know, we're all pretty much preoccupied with just trying to live hand to mouth, and start looking at the direction that we're going as a society and humanity as a whole. I started projecting things in a certain direction and kind of looking at patterns of things that were going on, and I decided that it looked like we're moving in a direction toward increases in natural and man-made disasters. And so I started kind of researching and studying and preparing in the area of general preparedness. And one of the areas that came up is by researching, I kind of ran into this area of weather modification technology and started, you know, accumulating and doing research on it, accumulating information. And there's some very credible evidence to support the fact that this is well-known technology at the level of some of the larger governments throughout the world.
But isn't there a conscious effort to cover this up from the common people so they won't know what's really going on?
Well, I think that is generally what happens in a lot of areas.
Well, we're going to be back here in just a minute. You hold that thought, Philip. Our guest this evening, Philip Hoge, we're going to be talking about weather modification. Can they really create storms and direct them? Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Philip Hogue. And so Philip is saying that some years ago he just got started researching this whole concept of weather modification, weather control. And so what did you find, Philip?
Well, first off, the Soviets were kind of pioneers in this area. And they really pioneered some of the weather modification technology, and actually there's companies right now, commercial companies, spin-off companies in Russia, where they'll actually sell you hardware or services. Say you've got some special event and you want to make sure you've got stable weather. They'll bring out one of their devices and for a certain amount of money guarantee that you're going to have clear weather. But nonetheless,
well, now, of course, couldn't it be right maybe 50% of the time whether it worked or not?
Right. Well, I think it's, you know, I know that probably one of your major concerns or interests in weather modification is to whether or not it has any application to what we saw down in New Orleans. And what I'd like to say is, yes, weather modification technology, there may be some really significant events that have happened in the United States, floods and whatnot, where we've seen stalled weather patterns or drought patterns. There are other factors that do significantly affect extreme weather patterns. And one of those things is solar activities and solar flares, because they affect the ionosphere, just like...
You're talking about now solar flares from the sun.
Right, correct.
Okay. And we can't control those, though, can we?
No, but what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to qualify this in trying to say that I really don't believe that what happened in New Orleans had anything to do with weather modification.
Okay, fine. That's
I think there are instances where we've had problems which potentially could be attributed to weather modification technology, but there's another area that science is just starting to catch on to that some other people have really pioneered and done a lot of studies in, and it hit right on the money with the hurricane in New Orleans, and that is solar flare activity destabilizes the ionosphere and disrupts our weather patterns and creates extreme weather patterns. And
all right, hold that thought here, and we'll be back in just a moment with Philip Hogue on weather modification. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Philip Hogue, and Philip was saying that certainly the solar flares can modify the weather here on Earth. They can. How does solar flares influence our weather?
Well, it's basically huge amounts of energy in the solar winds that interact with the ionosphere of the planet and the magnetic fields of the planet, and those are the things that actually have a massive effect on the weather patterns on the surface of the Earth. And this is something that NASA has just pumped a lot of research into in the last year or so, and they're actually starting to look at the correlation between solar weather and Earth weather. And in the case of the last hurricane, the hurricane started out as a weak storm front, but as soon as we had a spike in solar flare activity, it just injected a lot of energy into the storm system, and it just took off.
I see. So you think this maybe then was related to solar flares rather than anything that was man-made?
Right, but I'm not trying to discount the concept of weather modification warfare, or that somebody could even amplify the natural effects of natural weather modification. And, you know, it's like turning the dial up on an amplifier. When we look at what they're doing up in Alaska with the HARP facility, they've got some large natural gas resources there, and they converted that natural gas into large generators.
Right, and so these are actually through electricity then.
Right, and they're beaming that up into the ionosphere, and they can tweak it, they can move it in directions. And there's a lot of speculation about what they're actually doing with it. You know, it may have some anti-missile capabilities. There's a lot of things you can do with it, but, you know, the material universe is a cause and effect sequence, and for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. And, you know, in my point of view, when we start tampering with Mother Nature and doing things like this, we're setting up cause and effect sequences that have equal ramifications elsewhere in the whole system.
Basically, the HAARP system that exists in Alaska, the High Altitude Auroral Research Project, it is a top secret situation. There's a certain amount written in the research in the literature about it, but it is top secret military. And they can beam a billion volts of electric power up into the ionosphere and heat the ionosphere. And now they won't tell anybody what it's about. They don't want the Russians to know, obviously. Maybe they don't want Osama bin Laden to know.
The Russians already know about it.
Of course they do. It's really they don't want the American people to know. That's what it's all about. Obviously, we're not concealing anything from the Russians or the Chinese, because we give them all of our military secrets anyway. It's the American people. But what they're doing with it, some people say it can be used for incoming missiles. Some people say it can be used to alter the weather. Some people say it can be used to alter our minds because of the electromagnetic waves that they can put out. Some people say that it can be used to explore the surface of the Earth and what's beneath the surface of the Earth by bouncing these things off the ionosphere, and then you can measure the waves as they go down. And there's
and all of this is technically conceivable.
Right. But why won't the government tell us what they're doing?
Well, I think that, you know, as I say, the Russians started this, the Soviet Woodpecker systems that they had for years, and a lot of the shortwave operators have known for years they could pick up the pulse of the transmissions. In fact, I've got a whole series of pictures of a guy who went over there in the last 5 years, and he kind of bribed people and got pictures of all their transmitters and their transmitter facilities and their towers. I've got some incredible pictures of the Soviet HAARP or Woodpecker system.
All right, fine. Now, what's the difference between the HAARP and Woodpecker?
Similar concept. It's just the HAARP system's probably a little more refined system, probably a little more money thrown at it.
Well, of course, we got all the money in the world, and we don't have it where we just print it. But tell me, how can people see those pictures? Are they up on your website?
No, they aren't. You know, possibly in the next month or so, I'll be getting those up on our website, which is www.nodoom.com.
Nodoom.com, okay.
Right, and this is a gentleman of Russian descent that's now residing in Canada, and he went over there, and he's got just incredible pictures of their HAARP system. But I think the point is there is, as you say, a lot of advanced technology. There's some think tanks out there, and people are looking at the long curve about some of this technology, and it's downright frightening. I mean, the idea that frequency control of the brain and the idea of, you know, generating frequency fields over populations, you know, all these things are technically feasible. And, you know, the Russians worked with them, and it's not inconceivable that people in our military think tanks are not working with these same concepts also.
All right, now, let's get back then, though, to the weather modification. Isn't it true that there are some sort of treaties that we've signed with the Russians back in the 70s promising not to use this weather warfare, that if you could disrupt certainly the weather patterns over Russia, why, you could create a great drought there and famine, and of course they wouldn't even have to fight a war, they could do the same thing to us. Is this really a factor? Is this what part of this is all about?
They did sign treaties, and which, if you just look at the fact that they were signing treaties, you know, you don't sign treaties over things that you don't have the capability to do. So that's a pretty good flag of evidence that the capability exists. And in fact, our friend there, what was his name? I can never pronounce
it. You mean you're talking about Zygmunt Brzezinski?
Brzezinski!
Brzezinski, right. But in his book, Between Two Ages.
He went so far that he was talking about the idea. This is back in the 70s.
72, right.
Of warming some of the areas in the Arctic Circle. Now,
maybe they that way they could actually melt the Arctic ice cap and convince us it was global warming.
Well, you know, or maybe, and this is one thing that I've speculated, that the tampering they're doing with the ionosphere is contributing to the hole in the ozone layer. And, you know, he talked about this back in the 70s, and lo and behold, we're seeing the warming of some of our northern areas. They definitely have the hardware, they definitely have the technology, and, you know, we're seeing some cause and effect sequences that are out picturing here in extreme weather. Of course, some of it is definitely a direct implication to cycles of sunspots, but, you know, there have been some strange weather patterns that occurred in some of the long-lasting centers of high pressures that have occurred in the Midwest and off the coast of California, which produced either periods of extended drought or periods of extended storm, you know, where a weather pattern would just stall, which is a totally unnatural phenomena, you know, historically. There just is no precedence for it. And these stalling of weather patterns produce, as I said, droughts and floods. And so, anyhow, I think it's something to be aware of that basically the common man really does not know what's going on. And there are people out there who have resources and kind of the black box parts of our intelligence community who are doing things that are really not under the direction of representative government.
Well, now, why would they want to alter the weather? What would be the advantage of being able to alter the weather? Why would they spend a great deal of money to develop a system that would alter the weather?
Well, I think that from a strategic point of view, when you had the Russians fooling around with it, and they were doing it, and you get military planners, and they start thinking about warfare on more subtler levels, you know, this is a very optimum, say, Iran, for instance.
We could go ahead and put a real drought over in Iran so they couldn't harvest any crops, and maybe they'd be more willing to listen to our demands?
Well, I think that if anybody had the ability to stabilize weather, it would be a very covert tool for destabilizing a government. Because you get hungry people, governments tend to crumble.
All right, and then what about, of course, the ability to produce good weather so you can have good crops? Can they do this sort of thing?
In theory, they could strategically manipulate weather, yes. That's totally feasible. They could, quote, manage weather.
Okay, and so do you think that they're doing it?
That I don't know. I know that they've invested quite a bit into this hardware and this research and technology, and it's inconceivable that they're not testing it.
All right. Of course, there is a story that we were putting tremendous pressure on Israel at one time to sign an agreement. I've forgotten who it was, probably with the Palestinians. And there was a prolonged drought in Israel, and there was tremendous unrest there. And then as soon as the very day that they signed the contract, the United States government wanted to, suddenly there was a gentle rain that for several days, and suddenly now the crops could come up. Do you think they could have done something like that? We'll be back in just a moment with Philip Hogue to get his thoughts. Well, Philip, I was telling you the story, but I've heard the story, I don't know if it's true or not, that there was this prolonged drought in Israel, and they would not, they were absolutely refusing to sign an agreement we wanted to sign. But the very day after, you know, after weeks and weeks or months and months of drought, the very day that they signed that agreement, suddenly there was rain. Have you ever heard the story?
No, I think I recall that at one point. I may have heard that story. It's possible, you know. Is that the case? I really can't say.
There was a wonderful story, I remember. And it was, of course, having to do with Iran-Contra, when the Iranians had seized a number of Americans, were holding them hostage, and one of the major reasons that Ronald Reagan won the election in 1980 for the presidency was because Jimmy Carter couldn't get the American hostages back. There were some people who suggested that George Bush had gone over and negotiated an agreement with the Iranians that they would hold the hostages and they would not release them in October before the November primary. It was the so-called October surprise. They didn't want to be surprised and find out the Iranians were going to release our hostages. So as it was, why the hostages were not released, Jimmy Carter lost the election. Ronald Reagan won the election. And then, of course, on Inauguration Day, and I think it was in January, it was a cold, wintry a day, everybody, it was drizzling, rain was coming down, everybody was there with their umbrellas, watching the inauguration of the new President of the United States. And just before he was to be inaugurated, suddenly the announcement came over the loudspeakers. The Iranians had released the American hostages. And suddenly, the sky parted, the sun shone down, everything dried out, and we were, the president was inaugurated, we had a new dawning, a new administration, a new day. Now, I've heard that story from people who actually
had.
And maybe it was the hand of God, or maybe it was a man-made.
Maybe somebody was trying to simulate the hand of God.
Right? Well, maybe it was. It's an interesting thing to contemplate. Just so many coincidences happening at all at one time, but maybe just coincidences. But everybody remembered that, and it was sort of like a new day for America.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of things like this, and if you look at my book, No Such Thing as Doomsday, the concept that we have in the book is that there's no such thing as doomsday as long as you're prepared. And the other thing we've got in our book is some people worry, others prepare. And the whole concept is to turn your concerns into constructive action. And two things we do in this book. One, we talk about potential threats, which weather modification technology is a definite global threat, the potential there. We talk about the nuclear threat, terrorism, natural disasters, and then we go into what you can do about it, how you can turn your concerns into constructive action. And I think that we can look in a lot of areas, and there's a lot of very frightening things out there today, whether it be the degeneration of our Republican form of government in this country, the erosion of the U.S. Constitution, or if we just look at some of the totalitarian regimes overseas and, you know, in their attempts to exert themselves as a global power and display.
Hold that thought right there. Philip will be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Philip Hoge, who's done a lot of research into the weather modification, and he was just saying he's written a book called, what's the title of the book?
The book is No Such Thing as Doomsday, How to Prepare.
Do you have a website or a telephone number where people that'd like to get it can?
Sure. The website is www.nodoom.com.
All right.
You can actually go in on the website, and you can read a lot of the book right there. The chapters are there on the book, the website, quite a bit of it. And if you want to order the book, you can call 1-800-327-7673. 56.
All right, fine. So we'll give that telephone number out a little bit later again. If you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to talk to Philip about his concern about weather modification or other things, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we know that they've been working for a long time with weather modification. How much can they do? Well, we really don't know because they're not going to tell us. We know that they fly the planes right into the very center of these hurricanes. We know that they have the ability to actually funnel tremendous amounts of energy of radio waves in there, either by a harp or by other means. And do we have any idea the other means that they would have of getting energy into a storm?
Well, I think it's mainly through a harp system where they can directionally beam energy into the ionosphere. How well they can focus it, that's kind of an unknown phenomena. I'm sure that even the people that are working on those research projects are learning things every day. You know, it's kind of a trial and error program, I'm sure, that they tweak and they look for results and they see how well they can focus and refine the effects of the weapon.
Now, my understanding is that there's certain organizations, even here in the United States, that actually are working on weather, and they're private organizations. And if you want a storm, they'll give you a storm. If you want clear skies, they'll give you clear skies. And they have websites up there, and they guarantee the results. Have you heard that?
I know that there were some Russian companies that were offering that service. I didn't know that they had them here in the U.S.
Yes, they do. We've actually got the material on that. Bill Sardi has talked about that. And there are actually companies up there on the website that you can actually go to, and they'll guarantee the weather. So, can they really do it? Well, they claim they can. Of course, what they do is they have their planes and they seed the clouds create the clouds, or they certainly will do other things, of course, to make the clouds go away. And they seem to have a pretty good record of success on this sort of thing by using certain particles that will either absorb water or will exude water. And if you want to get the moisture out of the sky, they have these things, these particles that are very absorbent, and they can fly through an area that you don't want any storms, and they can utilize those, mist those out, and they'll absorb the weather, so there's not going to be a clouds. And then, of course, they can do just the opposite with their other types of material. Amazing technology that's out there that most people have never heard of.
Well, maybe it ties into the chemtrail program.
It may very well tie into the chemtrails program, which is another top secret government program that they're lying to the American people about. And we've had, at least on three separate occasions, I've talked to people who've heard this same story. Somebody in the military had asked their superiors what chemtrails were really all about. And the message had come back on three separate occasions why this is a government program to vaccinate the public to protect their health. Now, I'm not saying it's true or not, but obviously they're putting out a program of disinformation. Have you heard any stories similar to that?
Yeah, I've heard the same stories. And
Do you believe chemtrails are a real factor?
Well, they're definitely a real factor, unless you're in denial. I mean, because you can go for a period of 2 or 3 months and you won't see them at all. And then all of a sudden you'll see high concentrations of aerial spraying in grid patterns. And, they say, well, you know, this is just a natural phenomena from jets. But then when you go 2 months and you don't see it at all, and then all of a sudden you see a whole program where, you know, you got a web in the sky for another 2 or 3 weeks.
And then, of course, you see that the sky will be constantly overcast. These are not contrails. These are chemtrails.
Right.
And, of course, they will be there. They'll gradually, of course, fade and then opaque the sky. So they're up to something that's no good. The question is, what is it? And we're going to be back here in just a moment or two. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Here at Radio Liberty. this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Philip Hogue. And, Philip, go ahead and pick up the story there.
Well, I think the punchline, and where I really try to go in the book, there's a lot of people out there that specialize in books on how to scare people, and they usually got some little tactic at the end of the program as to how they're going to make money off it. That's not really what I'm trying to do. I try to awaken some of the people that are in a denial syndrome, which is very easy for a lot of people who watch too much TV in the United States and get programmed by our corporately controlled propaganda system out there. But what we try to do is give people some practical information on how they can prepare themselves to be more self-reliant. So if they are subjected to a hurricane, to a man-made or natural disaster, how they can be self-reliant. Because, number one, I think we all tend to feel very helpless until we can get to the point that we can turn our concerns into some sort of constructive activity. And one of the most constructive things we can do is preparedness. Not only that, I think that when we do look at these big disasters like New Orleans and whatnot, you know, the sheep-type mentality of the American people is that they got this in their mind that if something bad happens, the government's going to be there to take care of you. And I've been telling people from years to forget it, that, you know, FEMA and these guys have got other priorities. The federal government has other priorities. And they do not really have the resources to take care of people in their hour of need when you get these large-scale disasters. And we saw it happen in New Orleans.
But, of course, the government is the only thing that can be a total failure and then get rewarded with massive amounts of money for having failed.
Right. So what we do in the book is we talk about potential disasters out there. And one thing that I've seen and other people have seen is that we're seeing an increasing trend, kind of an accumulating spiral or frequency of increases in natural and man-made disasters. And I think it's following a very distinct path. It's kind of moving up to a crescendo. And I don't bring this up to instill fear in people, but to try and wake people up and say that you need to be more self-reliant. You need to understand that we live in a society that has a lot of mass distribution infrastructures, a lot of centralized infrastructure.
Hold that off right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Philip Hogue, and he's talking about his book and just saying that, you know, people should be prepared, that you really can't depend upon the government. If there is a natural disaster, it's going to be some time before they get there, and certainly everybody acknowledges a number of programs in this last couple of days pointing that the first 72 hours or more, you're going to be on your own. If it was a major disaster, it might be the first week or two or 3 weeks before anything would come down the line. And of course, what the government wants is total dictatorship, total control. That's what they're talking about, ignoring the quasi comitatus laws. And if there's any sort of emergency, they're going to come in and force you out of your home. They're going to come in and seize your weapons. They're going to seize whatever you have that they want. That is, of course, what the American Revolution was all about. We have a National Guard. We, of course, sent them all overseas to bring freedom to the people of Iraq. But here in the United States, why we have to have the military take over when there's a disaster, because the National Guard isn't here. And with that comes the loss of our freedom. I think we've seen an example in New Orleans. What will be next? What are your thoughts? Philip, what are your thoughts on that?
What are my thoughts on that? Well, I think you got a pretty good picture of the situation. I think that basically we've seen this in some large hurricanes and a couple of times now. And quite frankly, I think you'll see the day sometime here in the near future when we're going to see a nuclear event in one of the major cities. And I'm not trying to be a prophet of doom, I just, the technology is out there, and unfortunately, due to our foreign policy, which is pretty much corporately driven, we have made the American people, unbeknownst to themselves, have made a lot of enemies around the world.
In fact, and you couldn't do more to create enemies than we have done in this last year, the last 3 or 4 years.
Well, correct. We're doing a lot of the same things that Adolf Hitler did. You know, we're invading countries. He was headed to Romania to get the oil fields, and he had to cross Poland and Czechoslovakia to get there. You know, he was pacifying cities with saturation bombing. Those German boys, they were good patriotic boys. I mean, they loved their country, and they were actually pretty moral, and, you know, they thought they were doing the right thing, too. But if you get out and you travel around the world a little bit and you go to some third world countries and you start looking what's going on through the eyes of other people and not through the rose-colored glasses of the processed information that we receive through our corporate media here, you start getting beyond the propaganda system a little bit. And don't get me wrong, I'm patriotic, but I have a very different view of patriotism. My idea of the patriotism is the principles of the founding fathers and defending and upholding the U.S. Constitution, which every government official and every member of the armed forces swears an oath to defend the Constitution against enemies within and without.
Well, I'll tell you what, when I see what the Republicans and what the Democrats are doing, suddenly talking about $200 billion of taxpayers' money to give to the people in there, tragically, some of them have lost their homes. And my goodness, the casino people have lost their casinos, and we're going to have to build those casinos, and we're going to have to build bigger buildings there in New Orleans, and we're going to use taxpayer money without any justification at all, you know, in the Constitution, taking money from people all across America because of the tragic events that happened in New Orleans. Now, that is not the function of the federal government to rebuild a city or put in a Tennessee Valley Authority there, and that's what they're talking about. And it is the conservative Republicans who are doing that, because isn't it a nice thing to do? But they're not going to be spending their money. They're going to be spending our money. And if we want to volunteer, I think that we should be compassionate and concerned. But I don't think it's our job to rebuild the factories and rebuild the homes and rebuild the business districts in a city that was devastated by a hurricane because, of course, it's unconstitutional. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think that we all have a responsibility individually to be giving of ourselves. But I don't think that you can effectively ever institutionalize that function. And I think that's where churches and charitable organizations come in and people giving of themselves. My experience with institutionalized or government giving programs just lead to wholesale waste.
Well, I think that there's got to be a lot of giving to Halliburton, to Bechtel, to Fluoro, and of course all the other usual suspects who've been raping the countries throughout the rest of the world. And for our listeners, if you haven't read Confessions of an Economic Hitman, written by John Perkins, who is part of a small cabal that worked at the highest levels of international finance with the World Bank and the CIA, he called it the corporatocracy, rape the third world countries and drive the people into poverty. And of course they work with Bechtel and Fluoro and all these same corporations that have already been commissioned to begin to rebuild New Orleans. And you can't help but wonder, are they really concerned about helping the people? Or are they really concerned about helping Bechtel and Fluoro and Halliburton? Well, let's go to Mary, who's calling in from Buffalo, New York. And, of course, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Hi, Mary. How are you doing? Getting pretty late back there in New York, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I should be in bed. I like to go to a Messianic church in the morning, but I just happen to be listening, and it's right what I've been thinking about all this time, and everybody thinks I'm crazy when I tell them that they can do a lot more with the weather than most people believe, you know.
I think that they can, but we don't know what they're doing. Anything we say is speculation because nobody on the inside has come and told us the truth.
Right. Yeah.
Anything you'd like to say or question for our guest?
Well, three things that have made a lot of, three websites that have helped me a lot put the puzzles together were, you know about Ken Klein, productions.net, right?
Sure.
American Globalism, the False Prophet.
Right.
Victor Mordecai. He wrote, Is Fanatical Islam Global Threat?
I mean, that's, of course, it's his pen name. His real name is Avi Lipkin. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. But Victor Mord, it's actually Vic, VicMord.com. He's got, he tells of his 10 predictions for the coming year, like the draft and another, you know, like big attempt. Things like that. And then Steve Quayle, I read an article called The Fall of America on stevequayle.com. It's actually at harvestnet.org, prophecies, A.A. Allen. I was 5 years old when this vision was seen on top of the Empire State Building. And interestingly enough, the Statue of Liberty drowns down in the Gulf. So you might want to read it.
All right, fine. What's Steve's website, Steve Quayle?
Steve Quayle, that's...
probably stevequayle.com or
yeah,
we could
Q-U-A-Y-L-E. Yeah.
He lives in Bozeman. He's my neighbor. I know him real well.
Who's that?
Yeah.
Oh, Steve?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's
he
a good man.
My book.
He really did a good job. I've had him on talking about the dead biochemists, and, you know, certainly that I don't think this is happening by accident. We know that they've been doing all sorts of horrible experiments, inhumane experiments. We know that they've generated all sorts of new diseases. Lyme disease, completely new diseases. Nipah is completely new disease. SARS is completely new disease.
Right.
I mean, where does the H5N1 virus that they're so concerned about come from? We know that they went up and dig up the influenza virus from 1918. Why not just let it stay there? Why did you want to dig it up and have it possibly get out? We know that within the last 48 hours, three mice have disappeared from a stage 4 laboratory with the plague. Mm-hmm. My goodness, how could that possibly have happened?
Yeah.
I guess that they just made another mistake. Anything else you want to say, Mary?
Yeah, I just wonder, it's kind of, you know, hard to decipher whether I should be out there trying to evangelize as fast as I can, because it really seems like the fall of America is as imminent as anything I've ever seen. And, you know, that should I be putting my money into evangelism or trying to preserve myself? And I don't know.
You should be doing both. You should be making preparations, but you should be doing everything you can to lead the people to the Lord. And as things happen, as things get worse, as we have more trying times, this is the time when we hope people are going to begin to listen. But I think, Mary, I think things are going to get a lot worse, and I think that it's going to happen because people are not going to listen until they've lost all the material things that they have that they think give them security, and they're going to have to lean on the Lord.
That's actually probably what was a good thing about this horrible thing down there, is they had nobody to call out to except God, just like Terry Schiavo.
And I think that, of course, that I think we're beginning to see that the time of sorrow is a very difficult time lie ahead for our country.
Yeah.
And I believe God's going to let it happen. I think he's withdrawn his blessing. It's the only way to get our attention. Do you have anything you'd like to add to that at all, Phil?
Well, I know in my own life, you know, when I was going in the wrong direction in my younger days, that life hit me over the head with a 2x4. And I guess that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because I kind of looked at American society and some of the global society and the direction that we're moving in humanity, and my prediction is that life is going to hit the United States over the head with a 2x4, that life is going to crack humanity over the head with a 2x4, and it's not an issue of punishment, it's an issue of love, like the prodigal son, and getting his attention and turning him around.
Amen. I think that's well put. Okay. Thanks very much for calling, Mary.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's go to Darlene, who's calling in from New Jersey. Hi, Darlene.
Yeah, hi. I want to ask if you know anything about Senate Bill 517 about weather modification.
Yeah, I've got a copy of it, and of course what they're saying is that they want to invest money in weather modification. I thought it was so interesting that that Senate bill came up just at this time, just as Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, and of course But what people have to understand is Hurricane Katrina did not hit New Orleans. It was just simply the side of it. The major hurricane hit Mississippi. This was not a five hurricane that hit New Orleans. In fact, there was wind and rain, but this was not a severe a storm. In fact, it was 4 or 5 hours after the storm passed, when the streets were drying out, that suddenly the levees gave way. I don't know what happened. I think it's coincidence. It is not a coincidence, not one levee, but two levees gave way, far distant from one another. How could that have happened when this was not the major hurricane? The hurricane did not hit New Orleans. They keep saying 0.5 or, you know, level 5 hurricane. That's what hit Mississippi. That didn't hit New Orleans. So if it wasn't, it was a storm, but they have lots of storms there, lots of wind and lots of rain. This was not a hurricane force that hit the city. And yet we saw this horrible disaster, and I will tell you, of course, the oil companies are going to make out like bandits. They're already getting all sorts of special concessions for building refineries and all sorts of special concessions on their oil and oil rigging, and they're going to make an awful lot of money out of this before it's over, as are many of the people who are going to be involved in rebuilding New Orleans and, of course, rebuilding Mississippi. So anything else you wanted to say?
Yeah, I had heard Joyce say on the radio that I think her husband Dave had read a report going back to 2001 from Popular Mechanics, where they created a scenario there where they thought, you know, New Orleans could go down like that. So they all knew.
Yeah, way ahead of time. They knew this. They had a disaster plan, but for some reason, the disaster plan was not implemented. The disaster plan said, get the people out of the town. Because, of course, it's below sea level. If you think there's going to be a problem, evacuate the town and bring in buses for the people who don't have a means of getting out. Well, there are about 500,000 people who live in New Orleans proper. 400,000 left, or 100,000 left. And some of those would love to have gotten out. They didn't have any means of getting out. There were 400 school buses, 350 municipal buses, and you know what they did? Nothing.
No, they
left them there to be drowned, and why would you do anything like that?
A lady on AM in Philadelphia, she had Alex on the other night, they said that they told the people to go out and wait for the buses, and the buses never came.
Right.
So how could you do this?
Well, that's a very good question, Darlene. I think we all have to ask the question, how could you do that? How could you do such a bad job unintentionally? Maybe it was just bad luck, but you know, they had the plan. They did not bring the National Guard in until about 3 days. Why would you wait? They had 2 days warning that this storm was coming. Why didn't you have the National Guard there ahead of time when the president had declared this a disaster area?
No, and somebody from called Joyce one day and said she heard Kurt Weldon from Philadelphia on the radio, and he said, we're going to bring people down there. We're going to confiscate their weapons. We're going door to door.
Who was that? Was that Congressman Weldon?
Yeah.
Congressman Weldon. Well, of course, he's a pretty good guy on a lot of things. But anyway, of course, Darlene's talking about Joyce Riley and her husband, Dave Van Kleist. Anything else you'd like to say, Darlene?
No, I believe what Alex said the other night, that this is a, that, you know, I believe like what the Soviet Union, that was a trial.
And maybe I think like you're suggesting... It was a trial run to see if the American people would take the forcible, evacuation of people who didn't want to leave, and then the forcible seizure of weapons.
Yeah, and I believe that this is the same thing as a trial run.
What do you think about that, Philip?
Well, I think that there's an overall trend in the media and with the... Thank you.
And getting any of the material we talk about on this program. We have, of course,